Welcome to the CTO Connection podcast. I'm Peter Bell, and every week I'll be sharing an interview with a top engineering leader. Firstly, I want to thank AWS, who are our exclusive ultimate partner, and without whom we couldn't run our summits or the business. AWS offers a broad set of global cloud-based products to equip technology leaders to build better and more powerful solutions. Reach out to aws-cto-program@amazon.com if you're interested in learning more about their offerings. I'd also like to thank CodeClimate, our sustaining partner. CodeClimate is now offering full access to Velocity free for 45 days to the CTO Connection community. Velocity turns data from GitHub and Bitbucket into insights that improve the visibility of engineering work so that your team can stay aligned as they adapt to a distributed workflow. Check it out at codeclimate.com/CTOConnection and use access code CTOConnection. I'd also like to thank our other sponsors, including Andela, Bugsnag, CircleCI, iTechArt, Carrot, LaunchDarkly, and Optimizely for their continued support during these difficult times. And now on with the show. Today I'm talking with Kunal Anand, the Chief Technology Officer at Imperva. Kunal, thanks so much for taking the time to talk today.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Likewise. So as we always do, we'll go kind of back through dredging through history. And I see that you started your engineering career at JPL, at NASA, as a software engineer. What kinds of things were you doing there?
So my journey to NASA was actually pretty interesting. I'm actually not a computer science undergrad. My undergraduate degree is actually in business, so quantitative finance and economics. That's actually what I studied. My path to NASA was just a little bit unusual. I think I really cared a lot about how to build things like programming languages, how to build applications. And when I was in college, I didn't have that much exposure to it. We had a couple of information technology courses specifically about, you know, how to build a simple web application, how to program an Access database. And I remember my girlfriend, now wife at the time, we would basically go to places like Barnes and Noble, and I would sit there on the floor reading and combing and just ripping through as many books as I possibly could to teach myself how to program. So my journey to NASA was specifically wanting to scratch this itch. Should have gone to Wall Street, should have been a trader, I guess. But I decided that this is something that was just this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and I wanted to go there. And JPL is one of the most interesting places I've ever worked at, a place that's rooted in academia, but at the same time in how do you take these wild concepts and put them out there in the world? So how do you turn the idea of a Mars rover into something that's actually going to be something that runs on that planet and that works there? And so you have these insanely long lead times, right? Because you're thinking about how to design software, then how to build it, and then how do you actually launch it? I mean, when people talk about launching software, in my mind, I'm like, yeah, it's actually a launch pad. You know, like how to get something.
This isn't just feature flagging on a web app.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But you got to learn about like the speed of business in a world like NASA. So I learned so much. Lots of different programming languages, got to meet people from all walks of life. One of the things that was just so inspirational about being there was this cafeteria or two cafeterias that they had at the lab, and they were all open. Anybody could go at any time and anybody could sit with anybody else, and they actually encouraged that kind of behavior. In a way, it felt like JPL was the sort of college experience in engineering that I just didn't have, and I got to make up for it in that short, condensed time.
Well, and it's amazing because I was lucky enough to get to teach a Git and GitHub class at JPL a few years back. And it just blew my mind because most of the places I went into, you know, I knew a reasonable amount about Git. There, I would say in the first 30 minutes, they managed to ask 7 questions and I had no idea what the answer might be. I'm like desperately like, you know, pulling up source code for Git and trying to figure out how does it do that? It was just such a intellectually curious place.
I bet you probably had like a few engineers there that were like, so can I use Rebase to do this? Or that's the thing about JPL that always is amazing to me is very, very, very smart people that also happen to be very creative. It's this really interesting balance that you don't typically see in the world. You either see people that are very creative, but have a hard time applying those the sort of technical concepts or technical foundations to express themselves. Or you see the vice versa, people who are very, very technical, know the bits and bytes extremely well of a system, and they just don't have a good way to kind of express themselves, or you know, like it's an interesting tension, you know, that I've come across.
Absolutely. And then you moved from JPL to Director of Security at MySpace. That's a change of pace. How did that happen?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. So JPL's here in Los Angeles. I say here to those that are listening, I'm actually based in Los Angeles. Although if you kind of look at what I did last year, I'm maybe based out of an airplane. we can talk more about that later, what it's like to work from road, I guess. But I was at JPL for several years, working in the Los Angeles area. Actually, it was based out of Pasadena. And I knew I wanted to stay in Los Angeles. I really like it down here. And I was looking for an interesting opportunity because a lot of the work that I was doing at JPL was reaching its end. Again, you talk about building things for space projects, or you talk about building IT applications. You build those things, and then you hope one day those things actually launch. And the lead time on that can be 5, 6, 8, 10. I know projects that my friends worked on when I was there still haven't launched, and that's you know, more than a decade and a half ago. So it's kind of wild when you think about that. But I ended up going to MySpace, booming social network at the time. I always joke with people, it's kind of the social network that time forgot. If you think about it, people make jokes about MySpace all the time. But when I joined the company, it was at this really interesting state. The week I joined, they were launching MySpace Japan. MySpace was one of the original social networks. I would say the sort of original being Friendster, the more mm-hmm. popular one. And then afterwards you had MySpace. And MySpace operated a little bit differently than what we know as a social network today. So today you've got things like Facebook, which is more or less like a utility, more like your address book. MySpace was more creative in that it allowed people to be anonymous. You could be anybody you wanted to be. So you could put your profile up. You could do whatever you wanted to. And I learned a lot from working there. When I joined, there were maybe 30 million users, registered users, or 40 million registered users. And keep in mind, this was 2006. And so to say that you had a network or a property that had that many users back then was insane, right? I mean, it's very different, or was very different back then. And we were turning on MySpace Japan, and I remember the team scrambling because we had to account for the fact that in the US, the databases, I believe they were all Latin 1, if I'm not mistaken. And we were using SQL Server at the time. And going to Japan required us to go to, it wasn't just UTF-8, it was UTF-16. And so because of that, we had to actually look at doing data migrations and doing data casting and like re-indexing. And it was just a really big deal. And it was also the first time the company was working with an outside partner. So the week I joined, I actually was brought in for something completely unrelated to security. I was brought in to help build out their distributed file system. They call the DFS. When I was at NASA, I got to work on a couple of really interesting projects around distributed computing. And my exposure to distributed computing or DC in general was just the idea of that we're going to have lots and lots and lots of compute power in the future, and we got to find interesting ways to stitch that stuff together. And when I interviewed at NASA, they wanted to bring me in, at MySpace rather. When I interviewed at MySpace, they brought me in to run and lead their distributed computing initiatives. Because again, you're talking about 30 to 40 million users and growing. How do you serve all those assets? How do you build a social graph at that scale? There was no concept of a news feed that Facebook had eventually invented, but how do you leverage all this compute power to deal with all the scale? I think at its peak, we were doing something like 10,000 writes per second to a database. And this was, you know, 2006. Like, find a database in 2000, an open source database, rather, in 2006 that could have handled 10,000 writes per second. I remember we ended up working closely with some of the folks working on Postgres, some of the folks working on MySQL, and we actually deployed, we had vertically partitioned users. And I remember we had actually deployed one of the vertical partitions to one of those technologies, and we just couldn't get it to work with the stack that we had. I mean, it's no fault on those technologies. It's just at the time we were in a very unique space leveraging unique technologies, and we just had unique workloads. I mean, it was just all very different at that time. So I actually landed there to do distributed computing. And then in my first week there, it was really interesting because security was something that was coming up. The Sammy worm had happened a few months prior. Security was a big issue. And then they basically said, you seem like a smart person or sufficiently smart enough to maybe look at security stuff. Go over here. Oh, and by the way, we have this amazing consultant who's starting today with us. His name is Dan Kaminsky. You should go talk to him. And I'm like, okay, cool. I don't know who Dan is. I don't know anything really about security. This is going to be fun. And so I got to meet Dan Kaminsky and we hit it off. Like he and I like met each other and it was like, I won't say love at first sight, but it was, you know, kindred souls, kindred spirits. I mean, he's just this insane hacker. And I wanted to learn everything I possibly could at that time, you know, early on in my career. And I got to learn so much from pairing with Dan and it was just this amazing experience. And we ended up building lots of different technologies at MySpace, including like bespoke tokenizers and parsers to deal with things like SQL injection, cross-site scripting. So really applying what I knew about how to build programming languages and just my love for writing tokenizers and parsers in the context of MySpace to solve some fun problems. And we did. We solved lots of fun problems. Got to meet all sorts of interesting security companies, folks at Apple, folks at Microsoft, Google. We partnered with all those organizations. It was one of the most interesting times of my life. And yes, Tom is a real human being because everybody always asks me, was MySpace Tom a real human being? Yes, he is an amazing person.
Nice. And one thing that strikes me is just the variety of your career. So then you went from director of security to a director of engineering position at gravity.com, director of technology at BBC Worldwide. What were you doing in those roles?
So at Gravity, there were three people at MySpace that wanted to go and start a company together. And they did. It was called Gravity. And the idea was to build things like interest graphs. So leveraging in its nascent stage, things like machine learning to understand what people's interests were at the time or where they were going so that we could do optimization around web content, optimization around advertising, things like that. And they reached out to me after they formed the company and said, do you want to come down here and be the first employee? And at the time I was living in San Francisco. And they said, do you want to come back down to Los Angeles and start this company with us or be the first employee over here? And I was like, yeah, let's do it. And it was the first time without being an entrepreneur, getting to see entrepreneurs work. It was a really invaluable experience getting to watch them build a company. And it was, a first time CEO, first time CTO, and a first time chief product officer work. So it was just really amazing, just an amazing experience, amazing front row experience for what would eventually be my endeavor to start a company.
And then what about BBC Worldwide? That must have been a change of pace from an early stage startup.
Yeah, it was the exact opposite of, I think, what a lot of people think, although it really wasn't in that, I know it sounds cryptic, but when I joined BBC, they were incubating a lot of interesting technologies inside the company, and they actually wanted to get more agile, and they wanted to be a little bit more startup-y, and at the time, things like mobile gaming were coming up, and so they formed a group inside the company called the Digital Entertainment and Gaming Group. Inside of BBC. So BBC has two parts, the public news side, or the public service as it's called. Sorry, I don't want the brand people at BBC chasing me down. BBC public service, so like news, radio. And then you have the other side, worldwide, which is the commercial side. And that's for folks that love television shows like Sherlock or Top Gear, or even shows like Dancing with the Stars. That's a BBC show. That's the world that I lived in was the commercial part. And we got to build all sorts of fun projects. So things like web applications, mobile applications, and we operated more like a startup. We were a lean, mean machine, and we built experiences around more commercial things. And of course, we helped out whenever we needed to for projects like the 2012 Olympics. And we got to help out on like microservices, microservice-based architectures. That's when I started getting into the Go programming language, and I started getting into Node because we were looking at how to build microservices again before they were properly called microservices at the scale. So more like more of a service-oriented architecture, but lots and lots of different pieces that would sort of come together to allow people to build different kinds of abstractions on top. Could it be applications? Could it be experiences for like lower thirds on televisions? Things like that.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. And I always feel that microservices to me is simply the in vernacular usage, the way people actually use it. I think it's just a synonym for SOA, right? It's like, It's not everyone is doing like the whole Mike Feathers, like have all these tiny lambdas and compose 4,000 of them to build simple systems with, you know, 50 or 100 lines of codes per service. Most people have like 6 Rails monoliths all talking to each other, and then they call it microservices.
I think you're right. So if you think about the bigger companies in the world right now, and I'm thinking about the really, really large ones, a lot of them still have physical data centers. A lot of them still run very large workloads on, you know, on big iron. And how do they actually move those workloads to places like the cloud? How do they break them up? I actually think we're seeing a lot of replatforming work right now. I don't suspect that a lot of data that people have on-premise will ever make their way to places like the cloud. But I do imagine that people will build newer application experiences on top of these different architectures. So if you want to look at things like serverless, you've got things like Lambda, which is really interesting to me. So just functions as a service are fast. Really, really find that stuff fascinating. I love the concept of reactive computing. I love the idea of deploying functions. I mean, if we draw the timeline out long enough, maybe 10 years out, 5, 10 years out from now, maybe you won't ever write code again. Maybe the concept will be, I know it's hard to imagine, but like maybe you'll write just very, very custom code. And maybe a lot of the things will just be gluing pieces together. Like if you want a login experience, why isn't there just one company that's just specializing in just, you know, login functions that you know, like all the user management pieces just become functions that you are able to pull in, pull down, and kind of compose together. So I think what is interesting about serverless is the tooling around it isn't there. I love the fact that there's now these runtimes, but just the tooling around there to understand what the abstractions are, how are they communicating with each other? Are they doing what they should be doing? How do I build an actual mesh with these things? We're not there yet. Still early days.
And I think also it's solving a class of problems, and you need to really make sure that it's important to solve those problems before you go to the complexity. Because I'm building a new app for CTO Connection, and you know what? It's a Rails monolith. And it's very simple. It's very easy. I'm the only developer. And that's pretty much all I need. The idea of me breaking that out into multiple microservices and then having to deal with coordination, be able to run dev locally on my box, being able to run the equivalent of staging, or, you know, then we add feature flagging so that we can kind of test in production. All of those are great things. But I think, you know, you have to understand the scale of your team and the other requirements that you have before you're like, hey, we should just start off with 20 microservices.
But you bring up a really good point, which is in DHH or David Heinemeier Hansson, I really dig his opinions. I may not like all of his opinions, but I may not agree with all of them. He definitely has some hot takes. But I will say he did say something in a recent interview around Rails. And one thing I do appreciate is it's really a batteries included full stack solution. And everything is all there for you. And if you look at where things go, where things come from, where things go, like there's a sort of part of, I guess, the way we used to build stuff used to be giant monoliths, if you want. Now we call them monoliths, right? At the time, they weren't called monoliths. They were called applications. So we have these giant monoliths that unbundled or disaggregated. We had SOA, and then we had Arise in the sort of mid-2000s, and Rails was definitely beating this drum. You had the Django framework. You had a few others. The .NET framework, or ASP.NET, when it comes to building web applications, took this as well. Of what if we actually had more batteries? What if we had more pieces in there for people to be productive? It doesn't have to necessarily be the coolest and hippest and the greatest and latest bits that we have to glue together. What if we just made it really easy and all these things are out of the box? So I remember getting into Ruby. Rails was my gateway into Ruby in 2004, 2005. Ended up buying the Pickaxe book, the sort of trusty Prag Prog book.
Oh, yeah, Dave Thomas book, yep.
Yeah, and just seeing things like Action Controller, which is this insane thing, how opinionated it was around pluralization, like the fact that you can express these models. I mean, it was wild and mind-blowing, and only Ruby kind of lets you get away with that. And I remember, like, if you recall, like, then there was like this giant push, like every language that allowed you to build a web application then needed its own Rails variant. So that's where like Django came from. Like,
and you had Groovy and Grails, and you had, of course, the Yee framework and all the other stuff in the PHP world, Symfony and all of those. Yeah.
I'm guilty of building one. I actually built a framework in PHP called Toro. which was inspired by Sinatra for Ruby. So like a really, really simple thing. It's still used today. I know a lot of people still use it. I know it's still in production at lots of different places. But it's one of those things where it's nice to have batteries included.
And it was great to have that learning experience too. So I was programming, of all things, in Code Fusion in the late 90s and early 2000s.
Do you remember a person by the name of Ben Forda? He wrote a lot of the Code Fusion books.
Yeah, no, Ben's great. I think he's still at Adobe. Yeah, we keep in touch every so often. And I actually there was basically a dependency injection framework at the time called CodeSpring, brought by a couple of super smart developers who came from the Java world, but it was 10,000 lines of code to do DI. I'm like, wait a minute, this is a dynamically typed language. Why don't we use it as such? And basically by using recursion, I wrote something that I think it's the only framework that actually got popular adoption that was under 400 lines of code. There was almost nothing to it, but in 400 lines, you got DI, you got aspect-oriented programming, you got all the bits and pieces just using metaprogramming capabilities in Code Fusion. And it was like, yes, this is the kind of stuff that's fun to do.
I loved it. I remember when Code Fusion, I know that we're going to bore so many people when we say this, but like, I remember when like Code Fusion, or we'll excite people. You will know who you are when you listen to this. When Code Fusion went from everything just kind of laid out in just CFM and CFML files. And then you add components, CFCs. Right. And I remember like when CFCs happened, like just the ability to encapsulate a bunch of logic into these components that could be reused over and over again. I love that. And like things like, what was it called? Like on request end and on application start, those two files that you always had. I love it. I miss it. I do miss it. That's sort of opinionated approach to building applications on the web that I thought was pretty interesting.
The other thing I'd say is it was the first dynamically typed language on the JVM. Like before Gimla Forge and Groovy and tools like that, it was back in 2000, 2001, sometime then they ported it to the JVM, and you were able to like get really down in the weeds with undocumented stuff in Java, but you had the power of metaprogramming on an incredibly robust base, right? You had the JVM. Because, of course, the other story is, oh, great, it's PHP, only $1,000 a server. Whoa.
So let me share this one anecdote with you. When I got to MySpace, more than half of the website was written in Code Fusion.
Really? I had no idea. I don't think I'd do that. Wow, that is...
It's kind of one of those things that a lot of people don't know. MySpace was originally written in Code Fusion.
Wow.
And if I recall correctly, it wasn't the C++ engine under the hood. It was the Java port that they were running.
Right.
And they were running really hot in production. And that's when they started looking at moving stuff to .NET. And then they found something pretty cool, which was the ability to run Code Fusion on top of .NET. And there was a company in the US that actually created a runtime on top of the .NET framework, so on top of the CLR. And they built this abstraction layer that allowed you to run Cold Fusion, and it would evaluate and run on it, which I thought was really cool. But performance was really bad, really bad. Right. And so, like, the company was in the state where it was moving bits and pieces from Cold Fusion back into the .NET framework to get or ASP.NET rather, right, to get
the performance at runtime. Yeah.
But yeah, it was running Cold Fusion, which is wild. And by the way, just to nerd out a little bit more on the language side, we then got introduced to the Microsoft DLR team, the people that wrote Iron Ruby and Iron Python.
Yep.
Because I was really interested at the time to see whether or not I could build a Cold Fusion layer using the DLR.
Right.
So I kicked off a research project while I was at MySpace to actually I built a tokenizer and parser for Cold Fusion, because at the time it wasn't open. There was no open source for Cold Fusion, right? Around like the writing something that could parse CFML.
Not until like Rilo came out and stuff like that, if you remember the Swiss company. Yeah.
Yeah. But until then, like I ended up like writing a tokenizer and parser for it. And I was actively writing something to let Cold Fusion run on the DLR, or leveraging the DLR to let Cold Fusion run natively on there. And we ended up getting very, very simple primitives working. Like we got, I know it's going to sound crazy, like we got CF output so you could print stuff. We had loops, and I got queries all in on top of the DLR, which is exciting.
Nice. And for anyone who doesn't know, dynamic language runtime, it was designed similar to the CLR, but to allow you to run on the .NET framework, but optimized for dynamically typed languages. And now, some exclusive offers from my partners. Amazon Web Services offers a broad set of global cloud-based products to equip technology leaders to build better and more powerful solutions. Partnering with CTO Connection, AWS is now offering an exclusive program to our listeners. The program includes up to $100,000 of AWS credits, a free consulting session with an AWS solution architect to review your environment, your strategies, and optimize your costs, and other resources to help you to get started on migrating to AWS. If you're interested in learning more, please reach out to aws-cto-program@amazon.com. To lend a hand to those ramping up remote engineering processes, CodeClimate is offering the CTO Connection community 45 days of full access to their engineering analytics application, no strings attached. Velocity turns SCM data into actionable insights so leaders can get visibility into the speed, capacity, and output of their newly distributed teams. Your 45-day package will include access to the full capabilities of the Velocity Professional package, a consultation with a product specialist who will map your key initiatives to data, and a training session for engineering managers and executives about how to interpret and apply this data in a way that engenders trust. CodeClimate hopes that this will equip engineering leadership to take on a new set of challenges in the weeks ahead. To request access, head to codeclimate.com/CTOConnection and use the code CTOConnection. Then you founded Previty. So you went from, again, working at a company with a startup focus, but an established business, the BBC. What made you decide, that was okay, but I'm now going to found my own business?
So Gravity introduced me to the idea of starting a company. And I'm not going to lie, I got the itch. Getting to watch entrepreneurs work, getting to watch them think through a problem and really take the time to do it right. That was really interesting for me. And how do you approach a problem with first principles in mind? You know, if you want to solve a hard problem, and I love solving hard problems, that's kind of what attracts me to jobs and places. If it's an easy problem, it's not really going to get me to go somewhere. If it's a really hard problem, or if someone says something's impossible, that's going to make my head turn and kind of look at it and say, well, that's kind of cool. I do want to solve that problem. And at the time, was really looking to leverage a lot of the experience I had at MySpace, which was, How do we do a better job at stopping or preventing things like cross-site scripting in SQL injection? Because if you look at the OWASP top 10, and for those that don't know, the OWASP top 10 is really a taxonomy of the 10 most interesting slash critical slash popular, whatever you want to use adjective-wise, attacks that affect web applications and web application developers, or things that they have to think about the most. And things like cross-site scripting and SQL injection, I know for a lot of folks that are listening, you're probably like going, my framework handles this, or I have support for this. Well, a lot of people don't. A lot of people that are running technologies or workloads in .NET or in Java, they have to worry about things like cross-site scripting. And things like Ruby on Rails, you don't have to worry as much about cross-site scripting because by default, you have templates that do the right thing where they escape things like HTML.
Right.
What about for people that are writing stuff that are going into JSPs or just ASP pages? You have to worry about that stuff. And so at the time, things like cross-site scripting, SQL injection were on the rise. We started to see things like code injections, remote code execs, and was really looking at if there was a way that we could protect applications from within rather than relying on firewalls outside. And it was a contrarian approach. I met my co-founder, and he is an amazing human being who basically pushed me really, really hard to not just think about the technology, but think about the use case, think about the product, think about how we should position a technology like this. So not just that it's technically possible, but the fact that this would save organizations time. It would save them effort because they wouldn't necessarily have to go back to the older applications or the larger applications and close out findings from static analysis or dynamic analysis. So we built Previty. We started it in early 2013. And it was acquired by Imperva in 2018. I joined Imperva in 2018 in August. My daughter showed up into the world 1 month later. I thought I was going to go on paternity leave. And my CEO at the time called me up and said, we are going through an acquisition. So Imperva at the time was a publicly traded company. And it was being acquired by a private equity company called Thoma Bravo. And so we ended up, I ended up getting pulled out of paternity leave after that, during the sort of honeymoon of the acquisition and honeymoon of my baby showing up at just so we could help out on that acquisition. And we did, and we are now part of the Thoma Bravo portfolio. And in January, I was named as CTO for Imperva. So it's been, that was a rapid like 4 months right there.
Congratulations. Sounds like quite a ride. I'd love to dig in. One of the things you said just before we started this is that you're fascinated about the future of work, which is also a topic I'm kind of passionate about. How do you think, obviously, everyone's working from home now, and at some point in the future, that won't be a requirement. What do you think that the whole coronavirus experience is going to do in terms of accelerating, slowing down, changing the future of work?
So first, and as someone who's at home with a 1.5-year-old toddler running around and with two dogs as well, living in a tiny, tiny apartment, my daughter's heart go out to everybody, because it is really difficult to get stuff done at home. Some people were afforded the flexibility to work from home for a while now, and they've had that ability to be at home to get things done. For a lot of other people, this has been kind of foisted upon them, where they're now told that they have to work from home, and they don't have things like a desk. They don't have things like a setup like they would have at the office. And it's really, really difficult to get that stuff done. I've learned a few things. So at Imperva, we're about 1,100 people. Mm-hmm. And when 1,100 people that are geographically distributed, we have some of our core engineering teams in Israel, so between Tel Aviv and Rehovot. We have pockets of engineering in the east coast of the United States, so between Arlington and Raleigh. We have a team in Stockholm, Sweden, writing amazing code in Rust up there in Stockholm. We have folks in Los Angeles writing code and in San Francisco as well. How do you allow these people to be productive in a context that they've never really been in? Or if they have been in, they've never really been productive for this long of a stretch. And there's a few things that I've kind of observed, and I'd love to chat with you, Peter, about this, because we were talking about it earlier, and there's this sort of idea of flexibility. Mm-hmm. The traditional 9-to-5 schedule just doesn't hold right now.
Right.
It's impossible to get to hold to yourself to a 9-to-5 schedule. And if you and your partner both work, and if you have kids, who's watching the kids? How do you take time? Not everybody has a nanny. Not everybody has someone at home or a family member that can take care of their kids. We don't. So my wife and I take turns. And like that in and of itself is a really tricky thing. Like right now, as we're recording this, she's at home with the baby. And then when we're done with this, then I'll tag in and then she'll go and get stuff done. And so like it's this sort of ping pong. You have to be a team, right? If you're with other people at home. So this concept of a 9-to-5 schedule just doesn't hold. We have to revisit it. The tooling that we have today just doesn't hold either. So we are optimizing for lots of multiplayer work right now, I would say we're failing to optimize right now for multiplayer work. I think if we were all work from home and if everything was single player work of basically me heads down writing code, it would be fine.
Yeah.
Or if it was me doing HR things, it would be fine. When you have to start having team meetings and you have to start thinking through product launches. I mean, we're still going to launch the products that we intended to launch when we went into this year. Our business isn't going to stop. Our customers aren't going to stop. They want us to hop on calls. We have to completely rethink how we work as a team. And so there's tools like design tools like Figma, which are interesting because they bring this concept of multiplayer design. There's multiplayer productivity tools like Google and G Suite, being able to leverage docs and sheets. But we need more, right? Things like programming. And I know there's experiments like the Atom text editor has this thing called Teletype, which mm-hmm. I think it's what it's called, which allows you to kind of pair program with a bunch of other people. We just have to find different ways. I mean, what are your thoughts on this idea of multiplayer work?
I think there are two components to it. There's no question we need to continue to improve the tooling, but also I think we just need to get people used to the tooling that we have. I think that there were two things that were stopping at-home work, right? One part of it was the fact that there are some things that are more difficult. Some types of collaboration are more difficult online. It's not as seamless, it's not as easy. But then the other part is you just need to, some part of it is just getting over the inertia of, oh, it turns out we can do work remotely and we can manage teams. It's like when I look at team management, a lot of people are still like, well, if there's butts in seats at 9 and at 6, then I must be doing my job. If you're doing that, you're a terrible manager. Like, that's not the way you manage a team. And by taking a results-only work environment approach, you know, the kind of row stuff, it allows you to focus on what really matters. And then your job is not to ensure that everyone's sitting in the office, but to make sure that they're in the right headspace, that they feel good to check in using, you know, in stand-up, if somebody's in a bad place, and if they are, you do a 30-minute one-on-one, check in, what's wrong? Is your dog dying? Is your, you know, kid sick? Like, what's happening and how can I help? And you move much more to that kind of servant leadership role. And that is a set of skills that many people still have to learn. But when you do, it really becomes a superpower. I don't think it solves the fact that there are still weaknesses in the tooling, but a lot of this, the answers are out there. They're just not evenly distributed, right?
I agree. So I don't think it's as much around the tooling as it is around the process. So here's what I've been telling my teams. I've been telling them pretty directly to take time for yourself. I've been telling them that you do not ever, and I actually tell them, do not create a wall of meetings in your calendar. It's not healthy. We're at home now. We have to take our pets out for walks. We have to have our own bio breaks. We have to eat lunch. You can't work through lunch. So I've set policies internally where don't work through lunch. Just don't do it. If you need to take time, take time. People will understand. Creating more tolerance around meeting cancellation, throttling back meetings. I think an interesting side effect is meetings became a lot more efficient for us, where in a 30-minute meeting, there is no chit-chat now. I mean, we all cut to the point, which is, I think we all want 20 minutes out of a 30-minute meeting to do whatever we need to do for work and then leave the last 10 minutes so we can go and get a snack or stretch or do any of those things. I've been actually applying the practice of putting mental health breaks in my calendar, which is a relatively frowned upon thing. I don't know why in our world, it just seems so frowned upon to like put in something like that. Because then people ask you, are you okay? Are you okay? I leave my calendar fairly open so people in the company can see what I'm doing. I get pulled into lots of different initiatives, but I want people to see where I am. And I put in things in my calendar like mental health breaks because I do need that time. I do need that time so I can check in with my family. I can check in and be dad. I can be a husband. I can be a dog owner. And at the same time, I can also be good for my teams. You do need that time to reflect. You need that time to digest. Like, kind of like in computer science, like you can have a thread churning all the time, all the time, all the time. But like, ultimately, you need to analyze. You need a time to reflect. And it's really difficult to have lots and lots and lots of these threads operating at such a high velocity. You need to pause, and it's okay to pause.
And I think especially as an executive, because we do a lot to help to protect our teams, right? With giving them the maker's schedule and making sure they don't have lots of meetings dotted across. But it's very hard as an executive to say, hey, I actually need to do deep work. You know, the whole kind of Cal Newport deep work
book. Yeah, I totally agree.
I need to schedule blocks of time where I go for a walk in the garden or, you know, pace up and down my studio apartment, depending on exactly where you're sheltering in place, to bring richer thoughts so that we're solving the right problems rather than just solving the emergencies that pop up.
Yeah. I would say tolerance is a really important thing. Being flexible is important. I will say that people, when we were going through this change of sheltering in place and working from home, I think in the beginning, people were like, do I really need to do that? Like everywhere else, right? And then very quickly, it was like, okay, I'm going to do this, but I just can't work throughout the night. I mean, one of the challenges we have is, as a distributed team, I'm based on the West Coast, Pacific time, but we have folks in Israel. So UTC+1, right? And like, how do you manage that? It's just very difficult when you have a 10-hour time difference. And then we've got distributed teams in APJ. So between... We have a large group in Australia and in Singapore and Japan. And how do you manage all those folks? And you have to pace yourself. I think that's a really important thing. When we think about when we were talking earlier today, at least, when we think about the future of work, there will be more remote work. This is actually a really good thing. I think it actually moves a lot of the sort of concentration of tech talent or the requirement of tech talent to be in certain key cities like San Francisco or New York or wherever, we should see that unbundling or that disaggregation. That's great because it's going to mean that people stay back in their hometowns, which means that we won't see much of a brain drain. I'm really fascinated by, and you'll see where my head goes, like to these like second, third, 10th, 99th order effects, right? So like if you can keep like this amazing talent in their homes or in their hometowns, you now have people with higher income, right? Disproportionately higher income. Tech is, we pay as an industry extremely well, right? And for what it is that we do, which is sitting in our chairs, like jamming away on a keyboard all day. I always have to like take stock of the fact that most of us are just sitting in an air-conditioned office, just jamming away on a keyboard, while other people are literally breaking their backs to, you know, do amazing work for humanity and society. Yeah. I never want to lose sight of that, but you have a disproportionate number of people that, or people with a disproportionate amount of wealth now in smaller cities. And then it becomes optimization around if you have families, schools, like where do you actually want to be for optimizing around schools? You have tech talent that'll stay around home. You'll have an increase in tech talent and proliferation of tech talent, which means more courses. You'll probably have more educational programs. Colleges and universities will all be forced to level up because they want to keep that talent locally. You'll probably see bigger organizations or even smaller ones be less inclined to go take an office space. Bigger organizations may not have the requirement to build out large office spaces anymore because they will have swing space, right? Because most people want to work from home if we can get the tooling right. And then you think about like the side effects from things like that when you have like desk surfing, if you want to call it that. So I won't say like an actual WeWork where you actually rent office space per se, but like you have the flexibility to go work from anywhere. So I love the concept of like nomadic workers, right? And so it's just amazing to me.
Well, it's funny. I mean, and you have things like the WeWork Global membership that you can get through certain programs where you can basically drop in. And I used to actually work for WeWork. I was Flatiron School Boot Camp. So yeah. I used to do that. And it was great. Whatever city I was in, I could drop in. And I remember more than a decade ago, back in the mid-2000s, I lived in Australia for a while. I lived in Thailand briefly. And I would basically in each country just like, so where's the local Regis office, which was the player at the time.
Yeah.
And it was great to have that optionality, especially when I didn't have like kids and family and things like that. Just to wrap up, because unfortunately we're running out of time, we'll have to schedule another one of these to go deeper. But I know we said a lot of this is about learning the practices, about attitude, about tolerance, things like that. But tooling is still important. How do you think this is going to change? Like, what's the future in 5 or 10 years with tools like VR? How much better do you think the future of remote work can get?
So I think we'll see an increase in multiplayer work and the ways people rethink how to work. I expect in technology, we may see more organizations dabble in things like pair programming. And I know there's some amazing stories. We should probably link in the show notes for this. There was an amazing article about Jeff Dean and I think Sanjay Gemawat. I think that's how you pronounce his last name. I probably butchered it. I apologize. But it's about how they pair program at Google and how they built some of the most amazing systems at Google, including Borg and some of the other things. And there's a lot of good things that can come about it. And so I'm pair programming now, actually, with my team. I'm building a Terraform provider in Go with several people. And we pair program. We jump on a Zoom together and we will, one person will code, another person will provide feedback as we're going. And we can do switch offs. We can hand off. One person can test while another person writes the code. So I anticipate we'll see some of that. But long term, 5, 10 years from now, I would love to see VR come into play. I mean, I'm in a small apartment, wife, kid, 2 dogs, and I don't have space. I don't have a desk. I don't have any of these things. And so for me, I would love to be able to put a headset on and to be able to visually have a space. I think that would psychologically change things a lot for me, where instead of feeling like I'm cramped in a small environment, I work on a yoga mat when I'm at home, and I'm stretching a lot. but at the same time, I wish I did have things like a desk. I wish I did have space for large monitors, my keyboards and stuff like that. I wish I did have that workspace. And I think VR might help us bridge some of those gaps, assuming that we did have the analogs for putting things in places like here's my virtual stack of paper, or, you know, I guess that's where we'll see like things like skeuomorphism be applied to VR. And just a question of like, how analog do we want to get in VR land, or how modern do we want to be, or contemporary do we want to get?
And presumably it's going to be like most things. When we've started doing video presentations, like when we started doing TV, it was people standing up in suits reading from scripts. And then eventually we're like, wait, we can have lighting and people moving and maybe ditch the script. So I'm sure it will be that same process as we try to recreate the real world in the virtual world and then find there are actually new abstractions that are more effective.
I am watching Westworld right now. And everything that you're saying between the TV show Westworld and then another show that we're watching during quarantine is a show called Devs. It's on Hulu, and both of them are dealing with the concepts of simulation and whatnot. You and I can have a different conversation off of this because we can go deep into this idea of how we would want to work in, I won't say an alternate reality, but in a world where we could extend what it is that we do right now in VR. What could that look like? How would we meet people? How would we work together? How would we get things done? I think VR is very underrated right now. I think maybe a lot of it is just based on overall quality. I think a lot of people, when you put on a VR headset, it still feels unnatural. It's not like this. It's not like the real world. But it is good, and it will get a lot better if you think about where we came from in just a short amount of time, like from people who were writing code on 286s to now where like your smartphone is ostensibly like, you know, 10 million times faster than a 286 or something like that. It's wild, right? It's good times.
Absolutely. Canal, I'm really looking forward to continuing this conversation on a future episode, but for now, thank you so much for taking the time to talk.
Thank you, Peter. I really enjoyed it. And hopefully we can get another run at going deeper into some of these things that we touched on.
This episode was produced by the amazing team over at Dante 32, a podcast production agency focusing on content strategy, audio production, and distribution. Check them out at dante32.com. And if you'd like to receive new episodes as they're published, please subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving a review in Apple Podcasts. It really helps others to find the show. Thank you.